Well, hello everyone out there in podcast and YouTube land, and welcome back to the next episode of Top 100 from the Front Row Network. I'm Jeremy Gechner, here with me,
Brandon Davis.
That's right, as always. Wouldn't it be weird if we just like had like Craig and Scott here, just like one day, just like, we're going to take a break, they're going to give you our Top 100.
And it would be much different than ours.
It would be much different from ours. It'd be all Disney.
It might be more entertaining, though. Because
all Disney and all anti-Tarantino movies.
They're not afraid to insult each other.
Exactly. if this is the first time you're watching this, hi and welcome. But this is, of course, a show where Brandon and I give you our top 100 films of all time, 10 at a time. So last time we did our 100 through 91. Just as a quick recap for you, mine was number 100, Zodiac. Number 99, A Beautiful Mind. Number 98, Whiplash. 97, Toy Story. 96, Spotlight. 95, Amistad. 94, Inside Out. 93, The Matrix. 92, The Imitation Game. And 91, Yankee Doodle Dandy.
And my number 100 was Avengers Infinity War.
Nice.
My number 99 was American Graffiti. 98 was Stagecoach. 97, Toy Story 3. 96, The Deer Hunter. 95, Witness for the Prosecution. 94, Amadeus. 93, Up in the Air. 92, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. And 91, An American in Paris.
So there you go. I mean, that's all you need. Just we're done here. We're done here. Isn't it amazing that all those awesome films, and yet we've got 90 films to go? Like, this is just...
We love movies. What can we say?
Yeah, what can we say? We've seen all of these. What else can we say? We have a lot of time. All right, well, let's not dilly-dally around here. Let's get right into it. So, Brandon, why don't you start us off with your number 90?
Yeah, my number 90, a director from the Golden Age of Hollywood that I have discovered over the last decade is Ernst Lubitsch, who came from Europe and gave a European flavor to American movies. And my personal favorite Lubitsch movie is a movie that I discovered just about 5 or 6 years ago, and it's called To Be or Not to Be.
Okay.
Which a lot of people might know Mel Brooks remade in the 80s, but it was one of Mel Brooks' lesser works. But this movie stars Jack Benny and Carol Lombard.
Okay.
And this is a daring movie for 1942. This movie stares Hitler right in the face and makes fun of everything that he's doing.
Good.
And you can really tell that Brooks really got inspiration for the producers for some of this, because there is a moment where people say Heil Hitler, he walks in and says Heil myself. But it is Nazi Germany meets hammy theater actors.
Oh, well.
And Jack Benny and Carol Lombard play a theatrical couple who bicker all the time, and their egos are bigger than their marriage, basically. And they are doing Hamlet in this Polish theater when the Nazis invade Poland.
Sure.
And there is a wonderful gag in the movie where every time Jack Benny goes on stage and begins the soliloquy and says, to be or not to be, that is the question, somebody will get up and walk out of the audience and disturb it. And most of the time it is a younger man going to his wife's dressing room.
Yes.
And it is wonderful. And there are just so many. When I watched it, I'm like, I can't believe I'm watching a movie made in 1942.
Yeah.
They're making concentration camp jokes. But not tasteless.
Fairly Brothers movie.
This is very much a director, Lubitsch, who is saddened by what is going on in his home in Europe. And he's fighting it the best he can by giving Hitler no power by making absolute fun.
Yeah.
And it is a hysterical movie from beginning to end. And there's so many wonderful set pieces, and there's a wonderful finale. I won't give away all of it, but the actors take over the Third Reich offices by playing roles that they're playing on stage, and they're all playing Nazi officials.
Nice.
It is wonderful. It is wonderful.
Well, and you're right. Like, I think you think about that movie, and you do see a direct line for inspiration to Mel Brooks, because he's talked about how he thinks the best way to combat Nazism,
yes,
both in the past and in the future, is to make fun of it and to show it for the joke that it is. So, I encourage everyone, watch that movie. I mean, because it is a hidden gem there. So I'm glad that it's on your list, man. Mm-hmm. That's some courage. I like that. And speaking of courage, my number 90 movie is a film that I can't believe got made, and I can't believe it won Best Picture, but I went with Alejandro Iñárritu's Birdman. Birdman or The Unexpected Virtue of Ignorance. Now, pretentiousness aside there, this movie is... Again, this is one of those things where when a director has the courage to do a bunch of one takes as a movie, it gets to me. You know, the first time you showed me Rope from Alfred Hitchcock, I was just mesmerized by how much of a play it felt like. And I feel like Iñárritu is the guy who has taken up that mantle because he does a lot of one takes in all his movies. And this movie is one of the most stark examples of that. And the way it combines the one takes with how that combines into Michael Keaton's character as the story and the special effects they do in the midst of those one takes. I have no clue how any of this stuff works. But Michael Keaton is so good in this. And I don't want to take anything away from Eddie Redmayne's performance in The Theory of Everything that beat Michael Keaton for best actor that year. But this is one of those, like, life imitating art, imitating life performances. I mean, like, he's playing an actor that's seen as washed up because he played a superhero a few too many times, and now he's trying this comeback as a legitimate stage actor. And I don't know. There's something about Keaton's performance that is so raw and so real. And the scene where he's throwing around and trashing his dressing room. Again, I have no idea how they did any of those special effects, but it looks incredible. Edward Norton, Naomi Watts, Emma Stone giving amazing performances in this movie. And again, an ending that it can be whatever you want it to be, I guess. I choose to think the happier version, but I know that it's probably the sad version. But I just think it's really, really a great thing. And a great commentary on art, too, and how we don't let our artists grow sometimes. And so I just think it's a really, really great movie.
It is such an oddity. And I could not believe when it won, because the Academy is usually so...
They don't like movies like this.
Let's award the tried and true. And, you know, for something like that to break out. But I was so glad that Michael Keaton had this renaissance.
Yes.
I think people forget what a good actor Michael Keaton is.
Yes, they do.
And I love Eddie Redmayne too, like you said, but his performance in it is just, it's an original. I don't think I've seen a performance like that from anybody.
I mean, you think about that one take where he locks himself out of the theater and he's got a scene coming up and he walks all the way around to the front of the theater in his underwear because that's what the scene requires. And he's like giving his lines out in the audience because that's the only way he could get to the stage. Yeah. And I was like, those shots just stay in my brain. I can see them right now. And I just think, man, so daring of a way to shoot a film like this. So I just think it's great. So,
all right. Well, I guess we're going to my number 89.
Yep.
And my number 89 is a more recent film. You and I think the year was 2008, went and saw every single movie that was nominated for the Oscar that
That's
year.
That's right.
I haven't
Some
done
things
it.
Never
I
change.
Haven't done it before. I know, but I still don't think, we saw them all in the theater, though.
That was the thing.
But so that year kind of holds a special place in my heart just because I saw everything.
Yeah.
And my favorite movie of that year was my number 89 pick, The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. This movie gets a lot of hate from a lot of people. And I guess, I don't know, I don't understand why necessarily. Mm. It is long. It might come off as pretentious. A lot of David Fincher's movies do sometimes.
Mm-hmm, sometimes.
But I just love it. It captured me from the minute I saw it. It felt like old-fashioned filmmaking with newer sensibilities and technologies. Yeah. And I think it's one of Brad Pitt's finest moments on screen.
I agree.
I suppose on screen. It made me, for the first time ever, I really had never warmed up to Cate Blanchett before that.
Yeah.
And I totally did in that movie. There's a wonderful performance also by Taraji P. Henson.
Oh, fantastic.
A wonderful sequence with Brad Pitt and Tilda Swinton.
Yes.
And the movie's episodic.
Yes, it is.
Because you go through a man's life, and it's a modern American fable, and you don't get many fables anymore on screen. And just to see, you know, and it might seem a little, you know, creepy, you know, he's a young man, but he's really old. He's an old man, but he's really young. But it works. It works because Brad Pitt believes it every moment that he's on screen. Mm-hmm. And the way that Fincher directs it, it feels like an old-fashioned epic.
Yeah. No, and I mean, like, Jared Harris, Jason Fleming, just amazing performances scattered throughout this. I'm going to save mine because you're going to see that a little later in this episode.
Oh,
no. So we're on the same page there. My number 89, I'm going with the first of my Christopher Nolan movies.
Oh.
And I am going with the one that really cemented him as a star, which was Memento.
Oh,
now, this is a movie that look, it's difficult. The first time you see it, it's difficult. Yeah. You know, and unless you know what the hench, unless you know what the formula of it is in terms of, so Guy Pearce plays a man who has short-term memory loss. He can't remember anything for more than a couple hours. Mm-hmm. And he's trying to solve his wife's murder.
Yeah.
And if that weren't enough, the whole thing's told backwards. Now, look, when you hear that, uh-huh. you think, no, I don't want to watch that at all. But God, if it doesn't really work, and like each new layer that gets pulled off, every time they go back a little further and a little further and a little further, and you see just all of Lenny's like craziness come out, and Joe Pantoliano's doing a great performance here, mm-hmm. and Carrie Ann Moss with a great performance.
Yeah.
It's just one of those movies that after you see it, you want to watch it again to see what you missed
yeah.
that last time, and then you keep seeing what you missed, and you keep seeing what you missed. And it's one of those, again, that has a lot of questions that it gets left, but it doesn't detract from the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But you can see right here from this, Christopher Nolan is going to be a force, and indeed he does become a force
right.
and still is in the movie industry. But this is one movie that just always stuck with me, mm-hmm. like how unique it was.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Nolan is such an interesting filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
He's in a, you know, we don't see too many original, you know, Fincher, I think, is an original filmmaker.
Yes.
Nolan is in that same vein, where there are, you know, to use a very, you know, rigid film critic word, they're auteurs.
They are.
You know a Nolan movie when you
yes,
see it.
You
know
do.
A Fincher movie when you see
yes,
it.
Yes, you do.
And, Memento, I came to Memento a little later than some people. My first Nolan films were the Dark Knight and Inception.
Mm-hmm.
But then I came to Memento and I'm like, man, this guy knows how to tell a story. And you think telling a story backwards would be confusing for a night, but you're with it the whole way.
Yeah, and then also a mystery and one where you can't remember anything because the main character doesn't remember anything.
Right.
Like, it's really a triumph, mm-hmm. I think, that the script works at all.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's why it's on mine.
Awesome. Well, my number 88, we're going to go back to animation here.
All right.
And we're going to go back quite a ways.
Oh.
We're going to go back to the second Walt Disney animated feature, which is Pinocchio.
Okay.
I think Pinocchio, I'm going to be honest, Snow White is not on my list.
No, mine either.
If I did 150, Snow White would probably be there. I respect Snow White.
Yes.
For what it was. And I think there are wonderful, wonderful moments in it. But if you were to ask me what Walt Disney's animated masterpiece, there's another one of Walt Disney's masterpieces that are a little further up my list.
Right.
But if you were to ask me what his animated masterpiece was during his time, his tenure when he was alive, I think it's Pinocchio.
Yeah.
It's a beautifully drawn movie.
It
is a wonderfully told story, and it doesn't follow the early Disney formula of, you know, a princess and a prince. It tells a story about real feelings, real emotions, about, you know, Pinocchio wanting to be a real boy is sort of, I think Roger Ebert quoted it saying, you know, we all, when we're kids, sort of have that feeling, you know, are we real? You know, or, you know, will we be a grown, you know, someday? And, you know, just it's the love of a father and a son. And it's all these life lessons. It's, you know, don't talk to strangers. Don't tell a lie.
Yeah.
And they're told in incredibly dramatic, wonderful ways.
Mm-hmm.
It's dark at times. The Pleasure Island scenes.
You mean boys turning into donkeys?
Yeah. and Disney was unapologetic about that stuff because he said, kids can handle more than what you give them credit for.
Yeah.
And, you know, and he wasn't afraid to go there because when you go to those darker places, it makes the ending all the more sweet.
Yeah, I agree.
And, you know, I still think When You Wish Upon a Star is one of the most beautiful songs ever written. The character Jiminy Cricket, I know, can be grating for some people sometimes, but I think he was wonderfully voiced. But, you know, and every character in that movie, whether it be Geppetto, the Blue Fairy, Figaro, Cleo, you know, the Honest John, Stromboli, and Monstro, one of the most exciting climaxes with the Monstro the Whale sequence. And that's, you know, and you think they're doing all this stuff in 1940.
Yeah.
1940. And
for those playing at home, that's almost 80 years ago. Okay.
I have to go back and watch Pinocchio at least once a year because it takes you back to your childhood, but it also reinforces those deeper meanings that you think about in life.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, You said it all, man. You said it all. It's a great movie. It's a really great movie. Yeah. So, all right. Well, I'm going to jump into my 88, and it's one that showed up in your 90s. I'm going with Avengers Infinity War here.
Nice.
And this is the thing. Like, I would love to put it number one, but I've only seen this movie about 85 times. Again, we talked about it already, but the breadth of the movie, the building of 10 years of 21 movies, and somehow figuring out a way to make all of them work together and tell that cohesive story. And then I don't think that Josh Brolin's performance gets enough love in this movie. Mm-hmm. I think it gets a certain amount of respect because it should. But you're right, like when you said a villain that you despise yet can also relate to.
Uh-huh.
Because for him, it's not a mwahaha, I want to be king of the universe. Right. He's really kind of more of like an eco-terrorist.
Yeah.
You know, like he firmly believes that the world is doomed unless he takes a drastic action.
Yeah.
Now, that drastic action is killing half the universe. And again, give Marvel credit for going for that. Because, you know, if you're comic book fans, you know the Infinity comic, that's how it ends. You know, Thanos wins. But the fact that you've built up this empire of superheroics and then you decide to strip it all away there.
Yeah.
And I know we all figure it's going to get reversed somehow or something, but that sequence, the way that movie ends when all of our favorite heroes are dusting away is just jarring and draining on you. And the way they switch some of them up, like you think that Black Panther is going to lose his guard here, and then the camera shifts over and you know, it's him that fades away. And of course, how can any of us not cry when Spider-Man doesn't want to go?
Right.
You know, the Academy still is having a hard time reconciling superhero movies and the fact that they are not just popcorn fare anymore, that these are really good, deep movies with a lot of meaning behind them.
Right.
Seek out Bill Maher if you disagree with that, I guess, because he hates them. But it's the 10 years Marvel spent being very deliberate about the kind of stories they're telling and going after the top talent and not settling just for rah-rah entertainment,
right,
making sure that the characters in the story were forefront. And again, it might be more of a lifetime 20 movie achievement for Infinity War. It might not be the best made Marvel movie, but I think it is the most impressive Marvel movie.
Right. Absolutely. And so, I stated my thoughts about that earlier.
Yes, yeah, see the first episode.
All right. So yeah. My number 87, it's interesting. This was a movie I toyed with putting on the list or not.
Okay.
And I did. And it is JFK.
Brandon, you made me very happy.
You introduced me to this movie. Oliver Stone's work has always been hit or miss with me because some of the stuff he does is very kooky.
Yes.
but there are moments when you're watching JFK and you're saying, this is absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah.
And yet, I'm compelled.
Yes. Look, this is showing up later in my list, this movie is. And you're absolutely right because, there is some stuff in this that is just like, whoa. You know, and it's not, here's the funny thing, the conspiracy theories are not what make you go whoa.
Yeah.
It's like more of the characters that are surrounding this, but he makes it work somehow.
And he has this amazing cast.
I mean
with Kevin Costner at the helm, and then you have Tommy Lee Jones, very cast against type.
Very much so.
I still haven't seen Tommy Lee Jones in a role like that before, but then, I mean, and then he peppers it with, you know, Laurie Metcalf and Jack Lemmon and Ed Asner, Walter Matthau, and you see
J.O. Sanders, Michael Rooker,
Joe Pesci.
Sissy Spacek.
Donald
Sutherland.
Oh, and which is my favorite sequence.
Yes.
We'll talk about. Let's just the way that Donald Sutherland delivers the whole dialogue as X to Kevin Costner. When you're watching it, you're buying everything he says, and then it's not until after you see the movie you're like, okay, wait a minute.
Yeah.
But I realized, okay, Oliver Stone has a genius to make you in the moment buy absolute craziness.
Yes. No, you're right. And I mean, that's the key thing is like, Stone clearly has his idea of what he thinks happened.
Mm-hmm.
And he's unapologetic about putting it out there.
Yeah, I have no doubt.
At the same time, you know, when you see it all laid out, you know that something is off here. You know that what you've been told doesn't quite add up with the evidence. Now, I don't buy the literally everyone in the government was trying to kill Kennedy at the same time thing. But there are some weird things that happened that day and that happened after that. Mm-hmm. The government still won't answer.
Right.
And so, you know, like we talk all the time and place.
Yeah.
And this movie really gives you not mm-hmm. just the conspiracy theory, but also the emptiness that happened.
Yeah.
That was left there when Kennedy was assassinated mm-hmm. and how helpless the American people felt and how Jim Garrison, as you know, whatever you might feel about him for any of mm-hmm. the things he did in his life, had that conviction that this has to be answered for somehow. If nobody's going to bring a case here, like I'm going to bring a case here. I have more to say later in my list, but
yeah. And just, Costner gives a great. Costner's another one who doesn't get a credit for being
really
a good actor
not.
As he is. But his final summation in the courtroom
that whole sequence is awesome.
Is very, very reminiscent of something that Gregory Peck does much later down my list.
Yes, I mean, like, and it's not as it's not as artfully sincere as Peck's or as adored, but yeah, definitely his final summation. I mean, that whole mm-hmm. 15 minutes of his final argument is there, but it's the very last part that I think you're talking about where he talks about why it's important that this is there, that is very sincere, and you're right, Costner at his best.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, just everything about it, it's just, and it's a movie that stays with you.
Yes,
after
it does.
You watched it. It stayed with me for a long time after you and I watched it.
When
I was driving home after seeing it with you that night, I was like looking over my shoulder thinking people were following me.
Well, I mean, like, but you think, like, that final courtroom sequence, how uh-huh. he lays everything out, you know, like how uh-huh. Oswald, if their escape route is right, would have had to have gone past guards that never saw him.
Yeah.
You know, like stuff like that. It just, you're right. Yeah. It's nuts, but you know, you're right. You're just kind of like, wait, how did they know? Like,
Yeah, it stays with you.
It does. All right. My number 87, you talked about in your 90s. Uh-huh. I'm going with 1978's The Deer Hunter.
Nice.
Man, I held back some of my comments, but as always, the thing that sticks with me is that opening sequence of it, or the opening part of it at the mm-hmm. wedding, because they dwell on that part of this movie so long.
Yeah.
And when you're first watching it, you kind of feel to yourself like, is this wedding the movie? Because mm-hmm. they stay there for a while. But it's once they get to Vietnam and you see the horrors of what they're going through as prisoners of war. And mm-hmm. You realize why it's there. Because they want that stark contrast that everybody has, I think, unless you know it personally, a romantic idea of what war is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like you think of these rah-rah movies, you know, like that John Wayne used to mm-hmm. do. And, you know, now finally we're starting to get past that. But even here in this was really kind of, I think, the first time where I saw a movie that was unapologetically telling you, you know, like all those rich, like wholesome, loving things you remember about home. Well, imagine if literally all of that's ripped away from you and you literally cannot get it back. And that's one of those things that always stuck with me. And again, as you said, the final Russian roulette sequence is mm-hmm. just so gutting.
Yeah.
And so just seeing the blank faces of Christopher Walken as he is completely gone at this point.
Yeah.
Just an amazing performance, an amazing movie. And you're right, one that stays with you well after you've seen it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
All right, my number 86.
All right.
Is a movie that has a very close connection to a movie that came out this year. It is actually the second of four movies that came out. It is the 1954 version of A Star Is Born.
There you go.
I didn't put it on mine, so I'm glad you did. I didn't necessarily think about putting it on my list, but I rewatched it again when Allison and I did the podcast. And, you know, and if you've listened to the podcast, you know, she and I talk about it's an unfortunately flawed masterpiece because so much of it was lost.
Yeah.
And you know, it's been put back together again, well, you know, using, you know, stock footage and things like that. But it's one of the absolute greatest one-woman shows in movie history. With an amazing performance by James Mason.
Yes. Underrated performance.
It tells, you know, whereas this newer version in both the Streisand and much more, I think, in the Gaga and Cooper one, it tells the dark side of the music industry. I don't think any other movie has told more probably the dark side of the Hollywood industry than this 54 version. And there's so much life imitating art in this movie.
Yes.
I think about the scene where Judy Garland is in the dressing room after Mason has gone away, you know, to what would have been rehab at that time. It would have been much different. and she is telling Oliver, who's the head of the studio, you know, that whole thing about, you know, you don't know what it's like to see someone you love crumble away in front of your eyes.
Exactly.
And you can tell it's hitting home with her because she's talking about herself.
Yeah.
And
no, you're absolutely right.
And I think The Man That Got Away, the way that that is one of the best musical sequences. Like I talked about, the Bar American in Paris Ballet, the way the Q Corps shoots that.
Yep.
Just the genuine ferocity that she sings that song.
Yeah.
Is just amazing. And then, like I mentioned before, the Born in a Trunk sequence at the end of Act One is really like, you know, with Gene Kelly in An American in Paris, that was sort of, you know, that ballet. It's really a vocal ballet for Judy Garland,
because
she sings totally every different style of music or whatever. And but it's just, it's wonderfully written by Moss Hart, and it's got a great score by Harold Arlen and Ira Gershwin.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just, I think one of the most robbed Oscar performances ever, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, you can't, and with Mason too, I think, you know, I know Brando won for Waterfront, and I'm not going to argue that, and I'll be talking about that later as well.
Brando wins so many others.
But yeah, it is just, it is an, I know that it's a little flawed because of, you know, the politics that were behind it, but it's a touchstone.
No, it is, and you know, there's a lot of great Garland performances on mm-hmm. film, but this is, you're right, the definitive one,
mm-hmm.
and it's because you said it, the life imitating art, and the Q Corps didn't hold her back. You know, like he let her go.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what he said to her to get this performance out of her, but it is mesmerizing to watch.
It's like I said, I think Q Corps either wrote it in a book or something, or I read it. He said that during a couple scenes, he would go up and whisper in her ear, "You know what this scene's about."
Yeah. And you can tell, and you're right, like you perfectly stated the ferocity of mm-hmm. the Man That Got Away. Like, Judy Garland is one of the most keen, like, stark vocalists ever to live on this planet, mm-hmm. and you don't tell her what to do. You just say, yeah. "Hey, here's a song. You again,
here's
you know
your
what it's about. Go, like,
yeah.
and just do it." And
yeah,
if you watched A Star Is Born this year and you liked it, do yourself a favor and go watch the Judy Garland version. I know it's not the original version, but it's the one that I think is the most polished there.
Yeah, absolutely.
So. Very good pick. All right, well, I'm bringing us a little back, and number 86 okay. for me is the second appearance of Christopher Nolan on my list, as I'm going with Inception. Now,
nice.
This is a movie that I feel like keeps getting forgotten. And just so you know, like, you know, when Christopher Nolan made Batman Begins, the studio wanted him to make a sequel, and he basically did the Spielberg deal from Jurassic Park, where, if you don't know that, Spielberg said to Universal, "I will make Jurassic Park, but you have to make my movie Schindler's List that I really want to make." So Christopher Nolan did the same thing here. "I will make you another Batman movie, but you have to do this movie Inception that I'm thinking of." And it's amazing to me that, you know, Sarah and I literally just watched it the other night. The movie, again, is playing with such difficult concepts. Like, mm-hmm. literally, what if your dreams were a landscape for people to steal information from you?
Mm-hmm.
And there's spies in your dreams.
Yeah.
Like, that's a crazy idea. But the fact that the movie, the script does such a great job of guiding you along that craziness and mm-hmm. that really heady stuff. But it doesn't feel like it's just exposition for exposition's sake.
Yeah.
As opposed to telling you what's going on in this sequence, he shows you how it's going on in
yeah.
the sequence. And you think about some of the visuals in that movie, cities folding over on top of each other.
Mm-hmm.
You think of the fight sequence that Joseph Gordon-Levitt does as the hotel is rotating around.
Yeah.
And just the sheer ferocity of that movie at the end. And a great cast. Leo DiCaprio is acting his, you know, butt off in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And Ellen Page, Tom Hardy being introduced into the world, basically. You know, and again, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Ken Watanabe, all these people,
yeah.
Marion Cotillard, you know, so many great performances. And it really, once again, gives you the sense of how dangerous ideas can be
yeah.
and how your mind is one of the most powerful things
mm-hmm.
that anyone will ever see.
Absolutely.
So I think it's one of those movies that does not ever get the due it's deserved.
Right.
And I'm going to keep it on this list forever because I want it to.
All right. Well, we're heading now to my 85.
Okay.
And we're going to go very epic here.
All right. I like how we're going here.
We are going to go to Ben-Hur.
All right. This barely didn't make mine.
Kind of Ben-Hur. Yeah, it's a towering achievement.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, it's... You know, you can argue about Heston as an actor. There were moments where he was great, and there were moments where he was hammy. And in this movie, he shows both sides.
Yes, he does.
But you cannot just argue the scope. William Wyler, another wonderful director.
Yeah.
You know, this is the movie that, you know, for a while at least, saved MGM because of all the money it made. The first of the 11, you know, Oscar winners, which Titanic and Lord of the Rings would tie.
Uh-huh.
Just a really clever story, because it's this very personal story of Judah Ben-Hur and his relationship with Missala and the betrayal of Missala, which forces Judah Ben-Hur to go into slavery for years.
Yeah.
And his redemption is set during the backdrop of the life of Jesus.
Yeah.
And I think it's so
clever. Throw all that
in there.
It was
so clever on the part of Wyler they never mention Jesus by name.
No.
And it's all done, you know, when Judah's a slave and he's fallen on the road and you see this man who's giving him a drink of water and then you figure out who it is. It's so artfully done. And then, of course, at the end with the crucifixion and when his family, you know, Missala has put them, you know, away and they ended up being in a leper colony.
Yeah.
And suddenly, you know, they're healed at the, you know, it's just such a wonderful, wonderful tale of faith and redemption with one of the greatest action sequences in movie history. That chariot race. You know, staged by William Wyler, but done by one of the great stunt people of all time, Yakima Canutt, who, you know, Heston had a great quote. He said that, you know, I had so many questions for the stunt guy before we did this. He said, Chuck, just let me tell you, he said, you get in that chariot, I'll shoot it. I promise you'll win the race. but no, I really would love to see Ben-Hur on a big screen sometime because that chariot race, you feel every crack of the whip. You feel
when
the wheels fall off. You feel when people get trampled. I mean, it is horrific. It is exciting all at the same time.
Yeah, but I mean, like, you see, obviously Ben-Hur was remade a couple of years ago as more of an action epic.
Yeah.
And when I saw that, what I really came away with was, you know, that chariot race does live forever because sometimes the practicality of it, I think that the fact that they did it back then in the 50s and that it looks as good as it does kind of makes it so that you can't beat it. You know,
right.
Sure, our technology is better now and, you know, we could do different things in different angles. We could make you feel like you're one of the horses if you want to, but the fact that you're right, like they're all there and it's practical and it's just so epic. You're right. It is one of those movies where Heston's more overdramatic tendencies really work.
But they work because the movie is so heightened.
Yes, exactly. The story is mythical and you know, biblically betrayed, you know, like stuff like that. So you're right. It kind of fits more than something like if he was the way he acts in Planet of the Apes, perhaps.
Right.
So yeah, I really, really like this movie and avoid the remake if you can. All right, great pick. So I'm staying. Most of mine are staying. Actually, all of them are staying in the modern era here. So I kind of viewed this block of my movies as here's the movies that I love that have been more recent, but I think can start going up a little bit.
Sure.
So and I'm starting at my number 85 with Ridley Scott's The Martian.
Oh,
and this is one of those movies I was not expecting it to be as emotional as I thought. Now, I mean, like, if you haven't seen it, Matt Damon plays an astronaut on the first manned mission to Mars who they think is dead in a catastrophic sandstorm. They launch back to Earth and they find out that he survived.
Mm-hmm.
And so now he has to survive on Mars and with damaged equipment until they can figure out a way to come and get him.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, most of it is just Matt Damon talking to a computer screen for most of this movie. And it really showed me that Matt Damon is not just a movie star anymore. You know, and that sounds weird to say because his first big thing is, you know, Good Will Hunting, which is an amazing acting performance. But he started to fall into the action or the movie star, the good-looking movie star trope.
Mm-hmm.
And this one, he plays his charm so well, and it's funny, and it's, you just think to yourself, like, I would die so fast there.
Yeah.
And he doesn't, and the emotion of the rescue at the end is just amazing, and it's a performance that I think gets lost in the scope of the movie. This is a movie that I just continually keep enjoying every time I see it. And yeah. I'm hopeful that, you know, as we get even closer to more manned missions to Mars,
yeah.
You know, as that starts getting in the news more, that the craft of this movie won't be forgotten. So,
oh, yeah. I was pleasantly surprised when I saw
yes.
it.
Yes, that's a great way to put it.
I went in expecting, because I like Damon as an actor yeah. and everything, but I wasn't expecting the science of it. I wasn't
yeah,
expecting,
exactly.
you know, just the wit of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's much more than what it appears to be, and,
yeah.
and that's what I really, really enjoyed about it.
Yeah, and I mean, like, gosh, when something goes wrong on that Mars landscape, mm-hmm. I mean, it kills you inside.
Oh, absolutely, because you're rooting for it. He's an incredibly rootable character.
Yes, exactly, exactly. Yeah. So that's why I get it on there. It probably won't stay on my list, but I think it deserves some shout-outs now.
All right, well, we're going to go a little wacky with my number 84. And we're going to go into the 70s.
Okay.
Let's add a little Mel Brooks into this. It's Young Frankenstein.
Yes, okay. I had it on my list and it mm-hmm. barely didn't make it, so I'm so glad that you
yeah,
put it on there.
Perfect comedy cast.
Perfect.
Gene Wilder, Peter Boyle, Marty Feldman,
Terry Gar,
Cloris Leachman, yeah. and Madeline Kahn.
Yep. And Gene Hackman for good
Gene
measure.
Hackman for good measure. How brilliant of Mel Brooks just to make a film that parodies a group of films that even if you haven't seen them, you still laugh.
Yeah.
Because it's genuinely funny. And if you know those older Universal horror movies, it's all the funnier.
Yeah.
And it's just wonderful. Gene Wilder, my gosh, just one of the best, not just comedic actors, but actors.
Yes.
Could do anything. He could go into Crazy Town and make it completely believable.
Exactly. But he does it so quickly
yeah.
all the time.
But you believe him when he does it. And it's just a brilliant, brilliant comedic performance. And the whole cast from top to bottom, but I just, you know, Madeline Kahn left us much too soon.
Yes.
In the few little scenes, she's not in very much of the movie,
no.
but when she's on, you can't take your eyes off of her.
Oh, yeah.
And just, I mean,
just
the Taffeta darling.
Yeah, the commanding comedy brains, like the nails.
The
like,
nails yeah. Anytime someone says Blucher, and then. And Cloris Leachman's deadpan. And
yes.
she never, you know, she doesn't move a muscle in her face during
yes.
those first opening scenes. And Terry yeah. Garr is so wonderful in it. And Marty Feldman, you know.
Marty
what
frickin'
hunt.
Feldman, man. And you're talking one of the most quotable, like, Mel Brooks movies
yeah.
as well. But you're right, like, it always comes back to Gene Wilder for me because,
yeah.
again, an actor I don't think that's appreciated for his craft.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're right, he's mostly known for his comedic work, and his comedic work is genius.
Yeah.
It's absolute genius. And in this movie especially, like, he's given this dignified speech about failure and how you have to take your lumps, and then on a dime, just all of a sudden starts beating the crap out of this corpse. You son of a bitch!
Yeah.
Like, it's...
Yes.
I don't want to live.
Oh,
like it's so
it's
funny,
every, you know. And even the littlest bit, like I'll watch it and I chuckle at even like the littlest bits. And I can't like when, pardon me, boy, is this the Transylvania station? Yeah, track 29. Oh, can I give you a shine?
Yeah,
no thanks. I mean, parroting Glenn Miller is
yeah,
it's the best.
But also, you're right. Like when the callbacks to the original Moss movies, like when he's playing with the little girl,
yeah.
and instead of throwing her in a lake, he throws her into her bed.
And the cameo by Gene Hackman spilling soup.
Oh man, brilliant!
It's just great.
And
yeah.
I mean, how can we not call out Putting on the Ritz, man?
Yeah,
I mean,
something that you know Wilder and Brooks fought each other about. You know, Gene
yeah.
wanted to do it, Mel didn't think it would work, and
he
recanted. But and I so admire Mel Brooks for sticking to his guns and shooting the movie in
black and white
when
yep.
everybody told him not to, that it wouldn't sell overseas
yeah.
and everything. The movie in color, I think, would have been off-putting.
It would have been. And I mean, like, you're parodying the old Universal
yeah.
movies. Like, you have to make that look, you know,
yeah.
the way it is. So,
yeah.
I'll just say one more, Abby Normal. all right. Well, great pick there. My number 84, you've already talked about, The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. I echo so much of what you're saying here. Brad Pitt is an actor that is literally at the top of his game
yeah.
in this movie. But again, one of those people that falls into the glamorous, pretty, you know, handsome hunk actor mold.
Yeah.
And I feel like Tom Cruise is in the same vein as well. This is skill in this movie. And I said when I first saw it, it's one of the most quiet performances I've ever seen. And he's so reserved the whole movie in terms of what he's letting show emotionally. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, you could talk about the technology of this movie as well, because he does all of that performance except for, you know, the very, very end. But the way that the movie's written, how he narrates this stuff, it is life lessons. And I can understand how some people can find it pretentious. I mean, a lot of people thought the same thing about Eric Roth's other great movie, Forrest Gump. Mm-hmm. But the way that this unfolds, you're right, it has this twinge of magic throughout it, but not so much that you ever find it unbelievable. And you're watching a story about a guy who ages backwards. Like, it shouldn't make any sense, but somehow it does. And I think you're right, like Brad Pitt at the middle of that, again, just a tough year to be nominated for Best Actor, but he is so good in this movie, and it's one of those where I can remember the ending so vividly, and how he's narrating about how people are this, some people dance, some people are mothers, you know, like, and it gets me every time as you see those people he met throughout his life. So I think it's a great, great movie, and I think time will be better to this movie.
Oh, I'm sure.
Because I think it is a timeless tale.
Yeah.
So there you go.
All right. Well, my number 83, might be the biggest, people watching, might be the biggest on my list that some people, I don't think a lot of people, especially of our generation, know about this movie. This movie that's number 83 on my list is Random Harvest, and it's from 1942. Years ago, about 10 years ago maybe, I was watching TCM, and Sidney Pollack was hosting The Essentials that season. Mm. And this was one of the movies, and he said, "I know to a modern audience, a movie called Random Harvest from 1942 starring Greer Garson and Ronald Colman might not sound appealing."
Sure.
But he said, "Give it an opportunity, give it a chance." And I watched it, and I was mesmerized. This is one of the most beautiful romances ever put on film. It's a subject that Sidney Pollack said he tried to remake it for a long time, but he said the movie hinges on amnesia, which isn't so readily acceptable in today's age because of the way that we keep records and somebody just can't get lost anymore
because
they have amnesia. But it is a wonderfully shot movie. It's directed by Mervyn LeRoy, who produced The Wizard of Oz and directed a lot of different movies. It's your typical MGM glossy movie. It takes place during World War I and the years following. Ronald Colman plays a battered soldier who is shell-shocked, and it turns out the shell shock has caused amnesia. And he meets this kind woman who sings in the British version of the USO, who's played by Greer Garson, and she takes him in. And they end up falling in love, and they end up getting married until one day he goes back to London to find a job, and he is struck by a car, and suddenly he gets his memory of his old life back.
And what do you do?
And I'm not going to give away the rest because because he goes back to her old life, and you're wondering, okay, well, what happens to Greer Garson's character and everything? And it is a wonderful movie that you get a tear in your eye at the end, I guarantee you. But yeah, just a wonderful, wonderful movie. It's on the AFI's list of the top 100 romances of all time.
Yeah.
Like I said, a movie that really defines time and place, and a movie that stays with you after it's done.
Well, this is one I haven't seen yet, so you gave me one to go watch. Sounds fantastic. Mm-hmm. All right, well, my number 83, I guess you could call it modern, but it's early 90s, but I'm going with Clint Eastwood's Unforgiven.
Oh, I love it.
Now, this movie, you want to talk about something that is very self-aware, mm-hmm. and very meta at the same time, but is also such an engrossing character study. Mm-hmm. And you can't divorce the, I guess, gimmick is what some people would call it, of Clint Eastwood doing this kind of a character. Someone who made his bones on playing the tough guy cowboy, now playing a version of a tough guy cowboy that doesn't want to be a tough guy cowboy anymore, and going up against other tough guy cowboys. But the ideas being played with in Unforgiven, because when you look at the movies that Eastwood did in his cowboy days, they were very, I guess, unaware of, you know, the violence, and, you know, they kind of glamorized the violence a little bit. Mm-hmm. Not a ton, but it was in a sense of you don't really feel the depth of what's happening here. In this movie, it's really put to the forefront. You don't know what it's like to take someone's life. Mm-hmm. And you don't know the toll that takes on a human being. Mm-hmm. And the fact that, you know, like it is about William Money and, you know, he's trying to, you know, get money for his family and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And he's trying to take care of his friend, played by Morgan Freeman and everything. Mm-hmm. But I think the most dynamic part of that movie is the relationship he has with that young kid.
Yeah.
That's so brash and so brazen. And I'm going to go get these guys that cut up this woman, I'm going to mm-hmm. teach them a lesson. And, you know, when push comes to shove, you know, there's something about even taking a dastardly life, mm-hmm. a life that deserves to die in many people's eyes. There's a cost to that, yeah. you know, if you're the person pulling the trigger. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it still also has, I mean, Gene Hackman's performance as Little Bill is so good. And this is so thoroughly, like, it's such a perfect way it's a perfect Gene Hackman cowboy. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, it's a character that you think Gene Hackman as an actor would be in that.
Yeah.
But it still has one of the most stark lines as well. Two lines that always stick with me. One is, it's a hell of a thing killing a man. Mm-hmm. And then the other one is, of course, the ending where he says, deserves got nothing to do with it. And just those are just two of mm-hmm. the most stark, amazing lines I think I've ever heard Eastwood utter.
Yeah, and one of the best casts in yes. movie history. I mean, to have Hackman, Freeman, Eastwood, and Richard Harris,
he's great in that.
Yeah,
man.
And we'll go into, I'll be talking about this in the next
good,
episode.
Good.
So,
we'll save it for there.
All right, so number 82, we're almost there.
Almost there.
My number 82 is one of the most masculine movies in history.
I like this
It's
already.
Unapologetically masculine, and it is The Great Escape from 1963.
There you go.
I love this movie. I think it never fails to excite me.
Yeah.
And even though I know what's going to happen, I still think, oh, Steve McQueen's going to make it over that fence.
He's going to get there this time. He's going to clear it this time.
But yeah, I mean, just a wonderful piece of World War II history that yeah. that you know is, you know, blemished a little bit.
Sure.
But, you know, it's got so many of my favorite people in it. It's got Steve McQueen, James Garner, Richard Attenborough. Mm-hmm. He's wonderful in that, Richard Attenborough.
He really is.
And James Garner, just one of the most likable people in movie history.
Oh, yeah.
And so sarcastic. And McQueen, there was never anybody cooler than McQueen.
No, ever.
But I love it. I love, you know, it's a long movie, but it doesn't feel long. And just the methodical process of the way that they, you know, create this escape and the perseverance that it took
yep.
and the way that they, you know, most of them get out. And then of course we know most of them get captured again.
Yeah.
Only a couple, you know, James Coburn makes it,
yay.
And with his bad accent, but yeah. we won't figure that out. but John Sturges, who directed it, very, very well known for directing movies with all male casts, like The Magnificent Seven,
yeah.
you know, and, you know, I just love it. And, you know, that McQueen on the bike, one of the most iconic, I'm going to use,
yes.
I think I'm using your word the first time.
Everyone drink.
Using, you know, that, which McQueen did his own stunts on that motorcycle chase.
Which, dude, I mean, you hear that kind of stuff. I mean, it's like, man, the studio must have been sweating yeah. bullets.
and there's so many iconic, well, you know, just the sound of, you know, McQueen yep. and the tossing the ball.
The ball.
And him and Garner, you know, in the Revolutionary War outfits on
yeah,
the 4th
yeah,
of July.
Yeah.
And, you know, and even in the sadder moments, like, you know, when Attenborough and the rest of the guys, you know, are getting killed at the end.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's just a wonderful, wonderful piece of history that is always fresh and exciting, and it could come out today and be a hit.
Yeah. Oh, it's. I mean, you said everything about it.
Yeah.
You're right. It is a bit of a long movie, but there's nothing there that you can
yeah.
cut out. It's all necessary.
Yeah.
And again, kind of a Avengers type thing, you know, like bringing
yeah.
all these crazy personalities together to
yeah.
see how they're going to work together.
Yeah.
So it's amazing. It is an amazing mm-hmm. film. All right. Well, my number 82 here, I'm going with one I think is on your list a little later, but I'm going with on 82. Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
Could be.
Now, this movie, we watched it again a couple of weeks ago, and it's still holds up how impressive this movie is. Now, in today's technology with movies, you know, people mixing with animation doesn't seem that crazy.
Right.
I mean, like, if you just watch Mary Poppins Returns, you see how effortlessly that happens. Mm-hmm. But this was next level type of stuff with that. I mean, like, you see some of these scenes of Bob Hoskins just having to act with himself and how much, like, the set moves, like, you know, to counteract what the cartoons are doing.
Yeah.
But even aside from that, and aside from seeing all these cartoons in the same place, the mystery is good. It's a good mystery. It's a good noir movie. And it's just ridiculous.
Christopher Lloyd is terrifying.
Oh, my God. The eyes at the end, I'm telling you, and how, you know, he leaves the movie, let's say, is just amazing. But this is one of those movies that I think has already sadly gotten lost, and I'm on a crusade to try and bring it back, because it's one of the most technically amazing films ever. And then once you get that out of the way, once you get to it because of that, you see how good of a story it is as well.
Yeah, I will have a lot more to say about that a couple episodes down the line.
All right.
But yeah, I agree with all your sentiments.
Good. All right, one more each then.
One more. And I get, this is my World War II segment. I didn't realize
that. I was
ranking things. But my number 81, tough movie to watch. Not as tough as another World War II theme movie that's way down on the list.
Yeah.
It's Judgment at Nuremberg.
Oh, yes.
1961.
This is one I just barely couldn't fit in.
This movie is a masterpiece.
It is.
The fact that Stanley Kramer could take genuine movie stars and make them completely disappear into their characters.
Absolutely.
And not have them all be sympathetic.
Yeah.
And that he told, this is another long movie, but you're so engrossed in it. I love courtroom movies. And this is one of the best ones ever. You've got Spencer Tracy at the center of it as Judge Haywood. And, you know, a very fair-minded guy who's willing to, you know, even somewhat hear the German side.
Yeah.
You know, and at the polar opposite, you've got Maximilian Schell, who, in his Oscar-winning performance, who sometimes scary enough to the audience makes sense in some of his arguments. Like when he's arguing, you know, well, where was the rest of the world when this stuff was going on?
Yeah.
And, you know, and he makes his arguments. And yet, at the same time, you absolutely loathe the way that he treats Montgomery Clift and Judy Garland on the stands and rips them to shreds. But, you know, he's wonderful. And you have Burt Lancaster playing, you know, who's this all-American hero playing Ernst Janning, the old Nazi official. And you have Dietrich, who is playing, you know, the wife of a general who had been hung. And Dietrich being real German, you know, and having, you know, almost lost her life because she spoke out against the Nazis and went to entertain the troops over German borders and was in danger every minute. You know, and then you have Richard Widmark, who is wonderful. And then, like I said, Montgomery Clift and Judy Garland in very small cameos, but you can't forget them.
No.
You know, it's such an, I think it's a movie that, like Schindler, should be required to be shown in school.
I agree because, again, it's one of those, I mean, we just had National Holocaust Remembrance Day when we're recording this. And the stats about how many people either don't know or don't believe the Holocaust happened are very sobering. And when you have movies like this, it keeps it alive. It keeps, and I agree with you, it should be required viewing in schools. You fully see here a side of, you know, the horrors of the Holocaust that even Schindler's doesn't do, which is how ordinary people were swept up into it.
Yeah.
And how easily fervor and mob mentality can strip someone of their humanity and get them to believe and do terrible things. Mm-hmm. And it's Maximilian Schell that really makes that happen in this movie, because you're right, it's so easy to just say all the Nazis were terrible, all the German people who were Nazis are terrible, and they were. But there's complexity. People are complex, and nobody does it just because they want to be evil. And I think this movie really grapples with that, especially in Spencer Tracy's character.
I think about, well, there's two moments with Tracy in the movie that I think about. His final summation, which is brilliant, the whole thing. Yeah. But one of his very last moments where he said, "But in the end, this is what we have to stand for: justice, truth, and the value of a single human being."
Absolutely.
And then in the very last scene where he goes to visit Burt Lancaster in jail, before, you know, Lancaster will probably be put to death soon, when Lancaster, as Spencer Tracy is leaving, says, "Judge Haywood, believe me, we didn't know it would come to this." And then Tracy pauses, shakes his head, and he goes, "Mr. Yanning, you knew that the second you condemned a man, you knew that the second you claimed a man guilty, you knew was innocent."
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's one of those things. It starts with a small choice, you know? It starts with one choice, and it keeps going and going and going.
Yeah.
So, fantastic choice. Yeah. This was like my number 102 or something. It's an amazing one. Yeah. All right, well, one left.
One left.
So my number 81, again, this was more my modern section, but this is a movie that every single time I watch it, I love it more and more and more. And it is Danny Boyle's Slumdog Millionaire. So this movie did win Best Picture that year. And man, you want to talk about, again, time and place, but mostly place. You think about India, and you think, what, Taj Mahal. You think pretty much that, I guess, for people who've never been there. But this movie brought India to life in a way that I don't think has ever happened to me before. And the world of that entire country is just so vivid. And so, you know, Danny Boyle was the perfect person to do this. Yeah. But telling a story that is epic in its own right, and using something as colloquial to us as Americans as Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, you know, like that show is so huge, but then like everything in America, we forget about it in a couple of years.
Yeah, it's funny, when that movie came out, Millionaire had been off the air.
Oh, it was gone. Yeah. Yeah, it was gone. But, you know, over there, that's something that really can change your life. So, I mean, like everybody wants to be on that and everything. And I love that it wasn't the decision to, like, not make him a genius, not make him some kind of savant or something like that. He just had experiences.
Yeah.
And he just, the questions were the right questions. And I love that, you know, if you remember how that movie begins with, like, you know, Jamal, you know, is like, two questions away from winning a million rupees. And it says, like, how is he doing this? He cheated. He's a genius. And then the very last one was, "It is written." And you think about that in the context of the love story with Jamal and Latika, and it's just so heartwarming, and especially the last shot at the train station and A.R. Rahman's amazing, like, vibrant score there.
Yeah.
And especially the credits, though, of this movie also stick with me. You've got this kind of very gritty take on this continent. And then at the end, you still get this Bollywood flair.
Yeah.
And it's just like, even though you just saw something that a little bit heavy that still ends happy, don't forget there's still joy over there, and there's still joyous things that happen.
Yeah.
This movie just always sticks with me.
Yeah, it's a beautiful, beautiful movie. Didn't quite make my list, but Dev Patel's performance is wonderful.
Yes.
And I wish, you know, he's been in stuff, but I wish, you know, it's been, he's supporting people in stuff like, you know, Best Exotic Marigold Hotel.
Yes.
Which he's great in.
Well, and I mean, like, I was the same way. Like, he did The Newsroom for HBO, and he was great in that. But it wasn't until a couple years ago with Lion that he really kind of came back into the mainstream actor scene. And he is a force. I mean, like, this kid is a fantastic actor.
And that final scene, you know, at the train station with him and Latika, I'm like, you know, that's something out of, you know, Casablanca or something.
Yes, no, you're very much right. It's very old-fashioned filmmaking. And you don't even need words. It's just a gorgeous score and just these two loves of their lives that are just finally reconnected again.
And it perfectly, you know, it gives you every side of India. You know, you think, you know, we think living here, we know what every country is like.
Exactly.
You know, but it gives you, you know, there's good and bad in every place.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's, once again, time and place.
Yep.
Time and place.
Absolutely.
And Danny Boyle did it wonderfully.
Yeah, absolutely. So, all right, another 10 down. High five.
Wow.
So, yeah, that was our 90 through 81. If you join us again next month, you're going to see 80 through 71. I mean, look, I've got some war epics. I've got some comedies. I've got some crazy dramas.
Yeah.
Maybe even some silent movies coming in on my list. What about you?
I've got, let's see, I've got some Westerns. I've got some Disney. I have got I've got some musicals, and I've got a few mysteries.
There you go. Yeah, see, so, yeah. That's what they call a tease, kids. Yeah. But anyway, so if you want to see more from Top 100 or from the Front Row Network, again, as always, go to thefrontrowmoviereviews.com. Search for us on social media, the Front Row Network on Instagram or Facebook, and of course, Front Row Reviews with a Z on Twitter. And you know, just go and subscribe to everything on the Front Row Network. It's a good place. You know, we like it.
Yeah,
we created it, but you know,
you would think we'd get tired of movies, but we don't.
Nope. And then don't at all. But again, thank you for continuing this journey with us. We hope that you will come back for the rest of the list, the other 80 movies that are on this list. But this is going to do it for us. So for the Front Row Network and Top 100, I'm Jeremy Gettner.
I'm Brandon Davis.
And as always, we will see you in the front row.